Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Folks, start me up. It's Thursday. It's noon on the East Coast, June the 6th, 2013. We got a whole lot going on this year, this day, this week in the tennis world. Hopefully, you guys have all had a good week and everyone's getting out and hitting some balls and enjoying themselves. Today on the show, we're going to have a little bit of a different format today. We're going to have... looks like I'm going to be on the hot seat and have to answer Bruce. A couple questions. We got Coach Dave Getz with us. Getzy, are you there?
I'm here, Bruce.
All right. We're just making some intros here. Coach Getz is up at Penn. He's been on the show, but I quizzed him, and over the last several months, he's come up with a variety of topics that he feels like need to be delved into more deeply. So we're going to break for a commercial. Before we do, a quick catch-up on what's going on out there in the tennis world. Over at the French Open, of course, we've got Djokovic, who took down Tommy Haas in three straight sets to earn a spot in the semifinals of the French Open against Rafael Nadal, who took out Mr. Wawrinka of Swiss heritage in straight sets. That means we've got Ferrer, Tsonga, Djokovic, and Nadal squaring off in the men's. On the women's side, we got Sharapova about to take out Azarenka up 5-3 in the third after a good win over Yankovic the other day. And the second match, Williams and Arani will follow. On the men's double side, we got the Bryans storming into the finals, beating Paes and Suarez, and they're going to face off against Yodra and Mahut. Women's double side, in the semifinal matchups, Arani and Vinci against Petrova and Srebotnik, and Halakova and Hradeka squaring off against Makarova and Vesnina. A lot of tennis out there, and of course, if any of you missed it last week, the United States sent a team to Barcelona, Spain to compete in the Potter Cup. The U.S. team defeated Belgium and France and was downed by Spain in the final. So, folks, that catches us up on everything tennis. We're going to break for a quick commercial. When we get back, we got Coach Getz on with us, and we're going to talk a little bit about tennis. Stay with us.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
All right, Coach Getz, you coming to us today from the city of brotherly love. How's everything in Philadelphia?
Everything's wonderful in Philadelphia. I've actually been looking forward to this because I listened to your show, and one of the reasons I listened to it is because a lot of my friends were on. But the other reason I listened to it is I wanted to learn something. And so you interviewed me, and I had, halfway through the interview process, I realized, you know what? I think Bruce is a lot more insightful, and I think I could learn some stuff from him. So I asked to come back on and put you on the hot seat, and I hope I get a few pearls of wisdom from you.
Well, I think it's all the hours I spent in detention in high school where I had to enter into deep thought. So, you know, that's carried forward here, moving forward. Before we jump in, let me throw something out at you real quick to get us rolling here, just for S&Gs, as they say. So, you know, I've been reading a couple of different books that I find real interesting. One of them is The Talent Code. And this book, The Talent Code, kind of talks about what is it about world-class whatever, world-class musicians, athletes, mathematicians, physicists. What is it? Is there something about them that makes them so special? And one of the things they talk about are the coaches and mentoring. So the book doesn't just talk about what makes, you know, a guy like Roger Federer a great tennis player, but it talks about the coaches who develop these great athletes, these great musicians, these great doctors, neuroscientists, whatever the field might be. And one of the things they talk about, which is something I've always mentioned, is that I've always felt that one of the flaws within the tennis development system is that people always like new and shiny. They'll always hire a guy fresh off the tour who had a high ranking, thinking that, oh, this is the guy who can take them to the promised land and help coach somebody. And I've always felt like as a coach, you know, I don't know how you feel, but I feel like I get a little bit better all the time, and I really wasn't worth a darn until I'd done my 10,000 hours, just like you had to do as a player to be good. And it talks about in the book here, they talk about hotbeds, which is where they find the Brazilian tennis players, Spartak Club, the Russian tennis players that came out of there, some various music schools that are producing some musical geniuses. And here's what it says in here, and I'd like your opinion on this. The coaches and teachers I have met at the talent hotbeds were mostly older. More than half were in their 60s or 70s. All had spent decades, usually several, intensively learning how to coach. This is not a coincidence. In fact, it's a prerequisite because it builds the neural superstructure that is the most essential part of their skills as a coach. You know, what are your thoughts on the way we are hiring coaches in this country and the way that, you know, parents in tennis will try to take the college kid who they can pay $20 an hour instead of the, you know, the guy who's a little grizzly who's been around for a little while, or the USTA and their flock of 30-somethings, or, you know, any of that other stuff. What are your thoughts on that?
I completely agree with what you said. If it takes 10,000 hours to develop a tennis player, and it takes 10,000 hours to develop a virtuoso on the violin, why wouldn't it take 10,000 hours to develop a great coach? And I was going to turn this back on you, and
okay.
It was one of my first questions. And so
all right,
I was going to ask you, are you a better coach now than you were 10 years ago? And I would guess the answer is yes, but I want to know why, and how did you get there? How come you're better now?
Well, let's define the word better, okay, first of all. And then I'll answer the question. So I'm going to define the word better as more effective as a coach. Am I more effective as a coach? And I'm going to say yes, because in terms of just getting results, I might have been better when I was younger because I was ignorant and I was arrogant. So as a young coach where you think you know everything and you're ignorant and you have a level of arrogance that thinks that you can work nonstop for days, hours on time, you might force people into getting a result you want, but that's not really what coaching is. Coaching is really helping somebody reach their potential, and that's a long-term thing. Not just you made a kid a better player because, you know, you made him run so hard and he got so fit. That's a piece of the formula, but not out of spite, for lack of a better word, because you're going to make them good in spite of themselves, but effective. So I would say that now I'm a better coach than I was, and I would say because, one, I've never stopped learning, and I've always been able to continue to expand my knowledge base. You know, my knowledge base now includes some neuroscience, you know, everything from the myelination of nerves and how skills are developed to areas of understanding about hydration. I mean, you know, think about it. Way back when, we didn't even let kids have water. You know, that made you weak and gave you cramps and did everything else. So there's the hydration. There's the sports psychology, and which is something that has, you know, I studied it in the classroom and got a master's degree, but that's not really where it's helped. What's helped is playing all of these matches continuously all of these years and playing in tournaments to realize how it feels to be out there, and makes it easier to try to help a student find their way through the nerves. You know, you talk about the nerves. There was a special on the Bryan brothers I was watching last night on HBO Real Sports. And one of the scenes they showed was I'm not sure which year it was, but the Bryans were in the finals of the tour championships in London, and they won the match. So whichever year they won the tour championships, but before the match, Bob and Mike are on the bench getting ready to start, and the legs are bouncing a mile a minute, and one of the two, I don't remember who it was, throws up into a towel because he's so nervous he can't even hardly function. You know, and to understand that this is part of the experience is you're going to be nervous when you play. Why do we train our students? We train our students, then go out and play matches. That's the whole point. You know, why else would we train the students? Because that's where, you know, the rubber meets the road, match play. And to not be able to relate to how they feel when they get out there at that point in time and have to play and perform under pressure, that would be a skill that you must have as a coach. So that's something that's gotten clear in my head over the years. You know, I've become infinitely more patient with the students over the years. But I'll tell you the one thing that I think makes me a better coach now than I've ever been is I don't take it personally. I used to take it very personally if the student wasn't improving. And I don't take it personally anymore because I can honestly, I lay out a game plan, I move forward, I continually strive to find alternative ways of helping the student get to where I want them to go. So I'm not blocked by my attachment to the student's ability to improve.
You know what, let me ask you something. I want to know where you were wrong once. Tell me what you think the biggest tennis fallacy is that you once believed was true.
The biggest tennis fallacy that I once believed was true, I vacillate between two constantly, and I'll give you both of them. You know, I once believed that the only thing that mattered was being consistent, and you didn't have to try to apply pressure by hitting balls to different places. Then I came to understand that consistency is great, but if you don't have the accuracy to be able to open the court up to apply some pressure against a better player, then you're going to be in trouble. Then I began to understand that I was applying these sometimes wrong to the wrong players, meaning that if I have a player and I'm trying to make him an attacking, aggressive player, and he has neither the personality to be able to handle that nor the desire to play that way, then I'm doing him a disservice. From the flip side, if I take a player who's, for lack of a better word in today's world, ADD'd like me, and I want him to play 20-shot points every point in the match because I think consistency is the weapon this guy needs, I'm not doing this guy. I'm making a huge mistake. I'm preparing both of those guys to fail. So the big mistake I had is I used to have one sweeping philosophy that I felt was applicable to every player that I was coaching. And I've come to understand that that's a huge error on my part, that I've got to be able to take each player. And, you know, if I've got a player who loves to be creative, well, we got to hit the drops and the topspin lobs, and we need to do those things because those aren't low-percentage shots. They're only low-percentage shots if you haven't practiced them and you can't make 10 out of 10. But if you can make 10 out of 10 and you've practiced them and you understand the tactics with which to use these shots, they're not low-percentage. So to really understand each player and how I might have to coach each of them to play a little bit differently and to work a little differently, you know, some players also have come to understand, you know, they have to practice a little differently than other people. Maybe it's the day before a big match, but you got a player who I used to think day before the match to have a light hit. Then there's some guys who need to have a really tough practice the day before the match because it gives them confidence. So instead of me forcing my will on them for what I believe, somehow I've got to find a way to work with them on what they believe and make it as beneficial for both of us as I can.
Huh. See, I like that answer. I knew
if I got a hold of the show and got control, I could learn something from the thing. Because I learned that every time I talked, I never learned anything, which is why I wanted to do this with you. Okay, tell me something else I can learn something from. I want to know the best piece of tennis advice you ever received. Something that stood out in your mind. And
I'll tell you the best piece of advice I ever got. It was the day I met Bill Timm on December 28th, 1981, in Huntsville, Alabama. And I had it in my mind because they've been telling us since we're little kids, either you got it or you don't. Either you're going to be a good player, you know, either you started at a young enough age and you're going to be a good player and all that sort of stuff, you have it or you don't. And if you don't think you have it and someone's convinced you of it, you're always playing with doubts and with fears, and you get up a set in 5-2, but by God, you find a way to crap down your leg and lose it. So I go out on the court with Mr. Timm, and we hit a few balls, and he calls me to the net, and he says, it's the best piece of tennis advice I ever got in my whole life. It was the first thing he ever said to me after hello and, you know, get your stuff together and get on the court. He said, you know, he called me to the net, and he says, Bruce, I can teach a monkey how to hit a tennis ball. That's not what we're about. What I need is somebody who'll do what needs to be done, when it needs to be done, on the court, under pressure. That guy, I don't care how he hits the ball, what he does, that guy can reach his potential as a player. And that's the day I realized that, you know what, now that's the best tennis advice I ever got. That it's not about, did you start at 8 years old? Do you have a Western grip? Are you fast? Are you tall? Can you serve at 120? You know, it's not about any of that crap. It's about, can you hit the right shot at the right time? Not what you want to hit, but what you need to hit. And then you have to train accordingly so that you have those shots at your disposal. For example, one of the big things we always worked on was, you know, I'm about 5'10" on a good day, and I've never had a big serve, but I've always been pretty effective with the second serve. Because Mr. Timm taught me to play the second serve with confidence and practice it to the righty forehand. So I could pop the wide serve in the deuce court as the second serve. You know, most guys are looking for the kicker. You set them up with it. They're moving to their left. They're looking for a forehand. Then you can pop the ball wide. You at least get a predictable return. And if you can attack, you can volley or play an aggressive ball to the opening and apply pressure. Well, you know, just because you're shit scared out of your mind at break point at 4-all, you know, if you've practiced it enough and you believe in yourself, this is the time to do what needs to be done at that moment. And that's what you do. And if you miss it and double fault, that's fine. When you go home, you keep practicing your serve until you can make it. That's the best advice I ever got.
Yeah, see, that's awesome. Have you read anything lately? I'm always bugging people for their best books. And you know what? If you can read a book and learn one or two things, I think it's a worthwhile read. Have you read something lately that really either inspired you or you really learned a lot from that should be a mandatory read for anybody?
Every tennis coach and every tennis player could read a variety of books. I think certainly the players, the junior players, you know, who aspire to be great can benefit from reading books, you know, from Federer and Rafa and Rod Laver, The Education of a Tennis Player. And, you know, there are some wonderful books like that. I have two books that I really stick with. One is a new one and one is an old one. I continuously go back to The Greatest Salesman in the World by Og Mandino, which is a very short book and it's a quick read. And it's got some religious overtones, which, you know, aren't why I read it. Why I read it is the scrolls. The book's got 10 scrolls that are written in there that you really can make a part of your life and when you can. And my favorite scroll has always been and always was, and it was one that I made my freshmen all memorize, and then I gave them a different scroll after that, was the scroll marked 3, I'll persist until I succeed. And if any of my former players are out there listening, I'm sure they just took it from there and went with it. But basically, it's about persistence. And I find that this is helpful in all areas, whether you know, you're trying to get a project done at work and you need to get other people to help, but you have to continue to find a way and work through it, whether you're actually an athlete playing in a match, whether you are teaching a person and you're not really getting over the hump. You've got some player who you really are trying to help them get better and you want them to win matches, and it's, you know, you picture it's your number 6 guy on your team and he's got a lot of talent, but he's just not winning. You have to just persist until you find a way. So, you know, that one never leaves my side, The Greatest Salesman in the World. But the other book that I really enjoy from a learning point of view that I constantly go back to almost on a daily basis is this book I was talking about before, The Talent Code by Daniel Coyle. And, you know, he basically says greatness isn't born, it's grown, and here's how. And he gives a blueprint, and, you know, I question, because I have learned in my later life that not everything I read is factual, certainly, that there is some poetic license and people can make up, people can find the facts to support whatever they want. But there's so much in this book that matches up with things that I've experienced that I've been successful with, and then questioned, you know, was I doing the right thing? And the book factually verifies some things that you do want to do and some things you don't want to do. And some of the things they state, you know, from an athletic coaching point of view, he gives you some bullets for your arsenal when you're trying to make the point to your athletes. You know, my favorite are the mental barriers that they talk about. You know, and how they talk about in 1954 when Roger Bannister, the first guy to run a mile in less than 4 minutes, people said that this was the single, Sports Illustrated called this the single greatest athletic accomplishment of the 20th century. You know, less well known though is what happened 2 weeks after Bannister did it. Another runner, an Australian, John Landy, broke the 4 minute barrier. And then the next year, a bunch of more runners did it too, and then they started breaking it in droves. Within 3 years, no less than 17 guys had matched what they said was the greatest sporting accomplishment of the century. Well, what does that mean? That means that every time that you get a hold of a player who thinks that they can't do a certain thing, they picture themselves as the number six player on the team at Penn, that's crap. Guy could be an All-American. Guy could be as good as he wants to be or as good as he believes he can be. That's what that tells us. So I constantly pick up these things from this book that these awakenings that people can have. You know, the C student might be a C student because they struggle in school, or they might be a C student because somebody convinced them along the way that they're a C student. And when you can break these mental barriers in whatever areas, then there's no stopping a person at that point in time. And this book is full of factual examples that help you understand that our limiting beliefs and our limiting thoughts of how things get done are constantly getting in our way.
You know, I had a question about that. Now, I read all those books, Outliers, Talent Code, Genius and Talent are Overrated. There's a great book called Bounce out there. And they talk about, you know, developing from Federer to Mozart, how true genius and superstardom is created in any sport or any disciple. And I can't remember if it was Coyle in his book, but I wanted to ask your opinion about this. They said that purposeful practice is the key. You practice outside your comfort zone. And the maximum amount of time you should practice is 90 minutes to 2 hours max, because that's all you can practice in a truly concentrated zone for, and do it twice a day. So you break up your sessions. Now, I know, you know, some of the guys, Chuck Creasy will run a four-hour practice if he's got to. Ty Tucker will run a four-hour practice. But that kind of flies against that theory. What do you think?
Well, I think the law of diminishing return will certainly come into effect at any point in time. But I would say it depends is the best answer I can give. And it depends on how you structure the practice. It probably depends on what you're doing at the practice. It probably depends on how much of the time is spent in what we'll call deep practice or that purposeful practice when you're in that zone of time practicing that you're really affecting, you know, the habit formation. For example, you know, one of the best, you know, examples I can give, because everyone listening who plays tennis can visualize it. You know, when we're trying to work on the depth on the ground stroke, if we sit and just hit ground strokes all day long, it doesn't really do a whole lot. You can do it for 2 hours, 4 hours, or 6 hours. You ain't getting anywhere until you start putting targets down on the court. So either put targets on the court, or my favorite, if we're working on depth, is to string a rope up, you know, across the net about 3 or 4 feet above the net. And now hit the ball over that rope. And all of a sudden, now we get into deep practice and we start to form the habit of height above the net, which gives us depth in the court, which now starts to create a ground stroke that we would like to hit. You know, if we have width targets, even more so. So that depends on where you are in that practice. Just practicing for the sake of practicing, you know, that's of course, whatever you're doing can have a benefit if you're running around, you're getting sweaty, you're hitting balls, but you're relying on, without the structure in the practice, you're relying on the players you're working with to do the work that puts them into the deep practice zone. And if they were able to do that without you, they probably would be better than they currently are. So as a coach, it's imperative that we're helping these guys enter these deep practice zones. And if you give a good hard practice, 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon, you know, an hour of, you know, yoga, stretching, fitness, agility, whatever it might be on a given day, an hour of mental work, visualization, relaxation. I mean, we could come up with a full day of training separated into two-hour segments, and my guess is that probably be a pretty beneficial way to go about it.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, as a college coach, how are you going to go with the NCAA rules and the kids' class schedules and everything else? You know, you're limited a little bit in what you can do. You know, you might could do an early morning 1 hour and then an afternoon couple hour, but, you know, then you have to mirror match play. So for the tennis player, you know, like the golfer's got to go out and play 18 holes or maybe 36 holes if he has to do it in a tournament in the same day. So as a tennis coach, and you got guys who are playing pro sets, doubles first, and then two out of three single second, certainly, aside from everything else you're doing, there are days where you have to mirror that. You may not even be able to get that done in 2 hours. You know, you may have guys who play a three-hour singles match. Well, that's what you got to do, because part of the tennis player's preparation is preparing, and the preparation is playing in match points, playing set points, playing, you know, because every point in the tennis match, yes, it's worth one, but they're all not worth the same thing. You and I both know that if we battle a first set for an hour and 40 minutes and you win 7-5 in the tiebreaker, that point, that 1 point that you won at 6-5 in the tiebreaker, while it's only worth the same 1 point that it was at 1-all, 15-all, that point carries a lot more weight with it than the other ones did. So we have to practice those situations. We have to be in those situations to get comfortable with them.
You know, everybody, I think that's a great answer. So, yeah, I learned something else today. So I'm in the process of a little fact-finding and picking up a few more pearls of wisdom. But, you know, everybody and every team gets a certain reputation in the college season. Some teams, you know, they're all foreigners, or this guy will quit if the going gets tough, or he's a cheater. But I think your reputation in college tennis, it was, I remember you from 20-some years ago at Miami, was just a tireless worker, feisty, unbelievably competitive, driven, and competed his ass off all the time. But the other reputation that I had, that I always thought about you, was one of the guys that was a little bit innovative and that thought outside the box and had some creative ideas for player development, like Creasy does. Creasy is a really smart guy who thinks outside the box, and that was kind of your reputation too. So I guess my other question was, I want to know if there's something in tennis that you know you do differently than other people, and it's successful.
Well, I think, honestly, I think, first of all, I don't know that I'm capable of much original thought. So almost everything that I do, I learn from somebody somewhere. The majority of what I learn...
Putting thumbtacks in the back of a guy's shoe? Now, that's innovative. You couldn't have learned that. That was the Lipka original.
Yeah, it was Ken Lipka original, my dad. I was playing football when I was a kid, and I was a linebacker, and I was slow. And he said I was slow to the ball, and we were in Florida. So he got some sand burrs. You know, in Florida, you get those stickers in the plant, and he put the sand burrs in the heel of my cleats, and I started flying around the field. So ain't nothing original about that. It's just a question of having the balls to be willing to go deep enough that you're going to help. I mean, who wants me to be good more than my dad? I mean, the other coaches thought the man was nuts, but I was all of a sudden flying around the field. So who wants you to be, you know, you can't be afraid. You know, if you look at a player and say, listen, we're just not, I had a kid named John Baxter who played for me at Miami, who was as big and slow as anyone could be. But he wasn't slow. He moved slowly on the court, but John was not slow. Because every time I threatened John and we were going to run, and if he didn't make running times and an agility and anything, all of a sudden the kid could run like the wind. But he was always running heavy-footed, so you got to make him light-footed. So I took some thumbtacks, stuck them in the heels of his shoes, and the guy became an All-American with thumbtacks in his shoes. Had he played matches with thumbtacks in his shoes, you couldn't beat the guy. The guy had the softest feet ever. And then there was a carryover, you know, once you take him out, that he'd learned to move on the balls of his feet more like a tennis player would. He learned to be a little lighter on his feet like the tennis player should be. And there's a carryover. But I think almost everything I do, you know, a lot of the tennis tactics and techniques I learned from Mr. Tim, you know, over the years, you know, I've had some fantastic students who serve really as a laboratory for me, because I'm always experimenting and tinkering and trying to learn and figure out how to get where I'm trying to get the student. You know, for years, one up here in Maryland, I had a boy named Michael Shear, who when I started coaching Michael, you know, he hit the forehand in a full eastern backhand grip with the bottom side of the racket. And I say, you know, we don't have to change this, but if we do change it, we create some more options for you on the court. There's no good or bad. There's just the consequences of what you're doing. And if you can learn to do this, and if you can learn to do that, if we can serve this way, and we can serve more aggressive on the second serve, and if you can serve in volley, once a game, it keeps the guy on it, you know. And I go through these things, and at first, you know, the guy looks at you like you've got two heads growing out of your neck because you're saying things that have never been told before. You can't tell a 5'7" kid that he's got to serve in volley. It doesn't match up with the thoughts. A 6'5" guy, sure. So I think everything I do is a little different than most everybody else. And it's just because that's what I've been exposed to and that's what I've learned. You know, there were, I remember you talk about Chuck. There's years ago that I worked with Ken Heidinger for him at his camp at Indiana in the summer of, boy, maybe it was 90 or 91. And he was teaching a certain way, and I didn't agree with him. So I was young and not realizing you're supposed to keep your mouth shut when someone pays you to work for them. And I told him that I think we should do this differently. And it turned into one of the most epic debates on tennis technique that I've ever been a part of, which ended, you know, us at night with our cars pulled up to the tennis courts and our lights on, working through this technique, him doing his, me doing mine. But I think that's what I've never been afraid to say what I believe, and you show me where I'm missing the boat, and you can help me because I can learn from you. Well, I'll take what you're doing, and I'm doing it then.
Sure. My old man used to always tell me, know the world and steal the best. All right. This is, I just had, just from my own point of reference, I thought one of the other great Lipka teaching techniques that nobody really thought of or I hadn't heard of before, it wasn't the thumbtack thing. It was about, like, chaining the guy to the back fence, putting the ball feet 10 feet in front of him, and firing the ball at 100 miles an hour of the ball machine to get the guy to realize, you know, if you get hit with a tennis ball, it really doesn't hurt. Just keep your hands up front and make a volley. Now, that couldn't have come from Ken Lipka.
Well, that,
I think
we
that
call that overload training. We call that, oh, you know where I got that from? Overload training. We were running sprints, and we started running. The track coach said to me, take some of your guys and run downhill. They'll run faster downhill than they've ever run in their life, and they'll get that feeling of how fast, the wind blowing through your hair. So I thought, wow, that's a great idea. So, you know, we used to practice the serve return, serving at someone from the service line, but it was an unrealistic bounce of the ball. So I thought to myself, well, let's put a guy, let's use the ball machine to practice the reflexes, but pure reflex practice, not with a net, not, you know, ball machine on one side of the net, player on the other side of the net, just pure. And I got that from, I was watching one of the hockey goalies practice, and the coach was behind him, and he was in the corner of the hallway in the hockey arena. And the coach was throwing balls off the wall, and the guy was looking at the wall, so the guy was blind to where the ball was coming from, and he had to react to the ball. This wasn't, you know, with a hockey stick, with a hockey glove on the ice. This was pure overload reaction training. And I thought, wow, this is a great idea. So I got the ball machine out, and it was an old Prince ball machine that you had to crank the height on it. It would vacillate from side to side, but you had to crank it to make it higher and lower. So we filled it with the balls, and I set a guy up about 10, 12 feet is how I remember, but some of my guys may remember it differently. And the guy would be against the fence, and we'd turn the machine on, and fire as fast as it could the balls, and we'd have one guy cranking up and down and up and down and up and down, so the height would change and the width would change. But what happened is, once a guy errored, he would run away, which would defeat the whole purpose of the overload training. The whole purpose was to teach somebody that you made a mistake, but you got to regather yourself, hang in there, and get back into the rhythm of the whole thing. So we would tie a rope around the guy's waist and tie the other end to the fence so they had enough room to move, plenty, but they couldn't run away. So for 3 minutes, once you fatigued, you had to stay in there and finish the job. Just because you were tired didn't mean you get to quit. And the carryover, of course, to the tennis player is you just paid the longest point of your life, and now you're still down break point. you still got to fight through that again. So I felt like there was a relationship there between, you know, it wasn't just a masochistic exercise on trying to peg guys with balls, but I felt it was a way to teach a little bit of overload training and teach a little bit of grit to a player who for 3 minutes would have to stand in there because it got tiring because you get so tense. And the other thing the guys would learn, if they'd relax, they wouldn't get tired. They could do it all day. So that was my thinking there.
That's one of the things I think is interesting about you and Creasy, and Paul Scarpa is another guy that I think kind of thinks outside the box. What I think is interesting to me is how you've taken concepts from other sports and integrated them into tennis. And I think, so on that vein, I want to know, what have you learned recently? Something recently. I mean, you study tennis and you get better all the time now. That's why you told me you're a better coach now, because you keep working at getting better. You put your 10,000 hours and it's a craft, and you read books and you know the world and steal the best. You take other people's ideas. Give me a couple things that you've learned recently.
Well, recently in the last year, I've taken some old, you know, it's like you understand it deeper is a better way to say it. You know, I understand something at one level, and then the more I work with it and the more I observe it and the more I see people doing it, I understand on a deeper level. But one of the big things I've done off of the ground stroke is with the kids who are the better players or the adults who are the better players, I've kind of started them, instead of starting with the drive and working from there, I'm starting them all now with the topspin lob. And I start them with the topspin lob because it's the high, heavy ball I want them to hit, because it gets out of the comfortable hitting zone of the opponent. And it either backs people up, in which case you can move forward. You know, people are trying to take it on the rise, which is a skill that most are not taught, so not able to handle it. And it gives you the margins for error when you're under supreme pressure that you've eliminated the net as an obstacle and you've got enough spin on the ball to keep it in. So I've kind of started with the topspin lob, and then I'm backing off of that a little bit and lowering it, as opposed to starting with a lower ball or a drive and then teaching them later to hit the higher ball over the net. Because it feels like we really struggle to get the height on the ball ultimately, unless closer to the beginning, that's become a habit. That's one of the big things that I've been working with lately. Another one is on the serve. You know, we've really broken it down to the point where, you know, we're looking at, you know, we use Mr. Tim, you know, he introduced this to me, the serving stick. So he kind of takes a broomstick, and he'll kind of tape the broomstick to your elbows. You know, you look like the Scarecrow, sort of, with the broomstick running through the back of your shirt and out your elbows, you know, to really teach you the full rotation of the body, you know, because we start to think, why are all these kids getting hurt? So many kids getting hurt, and there's absolutely no reason to be getting hurt, the elbow, the shoulder. You should be able to hit 100 serves a day, no problem, and not get hurt. But you can't do it if you only hit the serve with your arm. If you only hit the serve with your arm, then you're going to hurt your shoulder, you're going to hurt your wrist, you're going to hurt your elbow. So we've really broken that down and got into where we make sure that the whole body, you know, it's almost like a chest pronation as part of the motion, as opposed to just an arm swing at the ball. You know, those are two big things that I've been working with in the last 6 months or so.
And you do myself and the players. You do that real advanced level too, Bruce? You do that stuff at the real advanced level? You do those drills and that, use those concepts at the real advanced level too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, with the best players, you know. You know, I was working with Bill. I was with Bill a little bit. He was working with Max Lippmann, who's going to be a freshman at Georgia, at Florida next year. And you know, I started picking up. And then Bill was working with Ryan Lippmann, his brother, who's an All-American at Vanderbilt this year. You know, and so I started to pick it up from there, and then take it on to, you know, some players from there. And it's really, you know, the biggest challenge seems that with any concept that you want to move forward with a player with, that, you know, it seems like the player needs to say yes, sir, and do it, and not have a debate about it. Otherwise, it defeats the whole purpose.
You know, the other part of the reputation that you have amongst the other college coaches and stuff, which I mean in a positive way, is you're a little bit of a maverick. And that's what I mean about thinking outside the box. And so I was just kind of curious, you know, there's got to be a few beliefs that you have. In order to be a maverick, there's got to be a few beliefs you have that other people don't necessarily agree with or aren't mainstream. You know, tell me what the belief you hold in tennis that many people would disagree with.
Well, you know, Mr. Tim used to say, if you're going to fail, fail big, huge, make it large. You know, if you're going to make a mistake, then by God, make it big, a grandiose error. And, you know, within the confines of integrity, morality, and good taste, you know, but still, you know, if you're going to try something, try it. Why not? You know, and I was never scared of losing. You know, and I was never, in fact, you know, I always thought that people learn more when they fail than when they succeed. I don't remember too many guys coming off the court after winning a match. You know, I just played an event last week, and I won a match in singles against a guy from Belgium, and I didn't learn anything from that match. Then I got my butt kicked by a guy from Spain, and I couldn't get home quick enough to start preparing for next year. You know, so it seems like we learn more when we fail. You know, and I learned that early on, that I think the thing you do is you take a student and you beat him, and you beat him bad. And if you can't beat him bad anymore, you find somebody who can. And because then all of a sudden, you know, they're open to learning, and they're open. And if they're not open to learning after getting their ass kicked, then the student isn't going to be any good for you.
You know, I completely agree. My old man used to tell me, look, if you lost and you didn't learn a thing, then you lost twice. And I completely agree. Let me ask you something else. There's a few things so you've changed your teaching style and stuff. What are you absolutely sure of in tennis instruction? I want Lipka's fundamentals that are absolutes in player development, and you can't get away from it if you want to be good.
I'm absolutely sure that, number one, Michael Shear makes bad calls on big points. Oh, no, you mean technically. Okay. I'm absolutely sure that the priorities for a successful shot in order, which are unarguable, you cannot argue these. And if you can accomplish this every time, you can create a tremendous tennis player. The first priority for a successful shot is solid contact. If you can't make solid contact consistently and you didn't learn, you know, I'm watching slow motion at the French over and over. I don't care if Federer lost, he's 31, whatever. You see this guy with his head stays down as long as it does. That's why his career has been what it has been. You've got to make solid contact with the ball first and foremost. Once you've done that, your second priority is hitting the ball over the net. You know, sit and watch a pro match of the best players and see they've just eliminated the net as an obstacle. They don't hit balls in the net. Once you've made solid contact and you hit it over the net, the next priority is to hit the ball inside the lines. Once you can make solid contact, hit over the net, and hit balls inside the line consistently, then the fourth priority is to hit it away from the opponent. I'm 100% sure that the problem with most tennis players is they have skipped to number four without learning 1, 2, and 3 in that order and making them have it.
I missed number four. Give me four again, Bruce.
Hit it away from your opponent. And the problem is, most tennis players learn that one first, because when you're a beginner and you go out and play, you can actually accomplish that one and still hit it pretty far inside the court. But then as people get better and cover more court and get faster and you try to avoid the opponent, you just miss. So you never solidified the habits of solid contact over the net and inside the lines. And when I talk to guys like, you know, Paul Goldstein and Emilio Sanchez and some of these other guys who've been great players, somewhere early on, they realized that the object here was to keep hitting the ball in the court over and over again. And that becomes the overriding habit they've developed, as opposed to avoiding the other guy.
What about the fifth one? Just for me, I always thought most of the matches I lost, and when I lost bad, I just got so hurried, man. Everything was happening so fast. The ball was on me quicker than I was used to. I'd serve and volley and come in, and that return's just on me too fast. And even from the ground strokes, I just felt worried and pressured, like I didn't have time. Where do you put in taking away the person's time?
I've always felt like that's a great weapon. If you can take time away from someone, you know, why do we play the net? We play the net because, you know, we can take time away from somebody, and we can cause somebody to have less court to hit to. But what you're talking about, you know, I think is what happens to all of us in every sport. You know, you watch the free throw shooter under pressure. The really great one has routines, you know, and bounces the ball and takes the breath, and it's always the same rhythm. You know, the poorer shooter's rhythm changes with pressure. The tennis player, the same. You know, the tennis player, they start to swing fast, they start to shank balls, they start to miss, which is why the priorities are in the order that I give them in. Because if we go back to focusing on seeing the ball leave our opponent's strings, see it bounce and hit in our strings and focus on that, the swing could slow down. You know, the focus doesn't become now on how you're hitting the ball, but the focus becomes how you're playing tennis. You know, certainly a great way to apply pressure is to take time away. I mean, I look at guys like Isner and, you know, Roddick and Query, and I don't understand for the life of me why when these guys were younger, they didn't learn to move forward more to be able to take time away from their opponent, because their ability to cover the front part of the court should be so fantastic, yet never happened. They never learned the value of taking time away. You know, what value they probably learned was not missing and making lots of balls.
You know, I was curious about the talent code and a lot of stuff. The other question I had to ask you was, when I was 18 and John McEnroe was 16, we were pretty close. I mean, I kind of thought maybe I was better than he was, but he wasn't number one in the country even in the 16. But yet a couple years later, I practiced, I think, as hard as I could have possibly practiced, 6 hours a day, seven. I did anything I could because I wanted to be a pro tennis player. And all of a sudden, 2 years later, I'm a mediocre college player, and I look over and I see McEnroe in the semis of Wimbledon losing to Jimmy Connors in four sets. And I call up my friend Greg King, who was at Stanford at the time, who was a teammate of McEnroe's, and I said, God, how did this happen? The guy must practice like an animal. He said, no. He said, he's the laziest guy on the team. He wouldn't do any of the weights. He'd come out, play a half hour, mini. So how do you explain that? Because this stuff says it's purposeful practice. It's building the neuroreceptors and all this. And I guarantee you, from the time we were fairly close, I would guarantee I practiced harder than John did. And I wasn't.
I think it's the four-minute mile. It's the four-minute mile. It's a belief system. You know, they used to say that, you know, whether you believe it or don't, you're right. You know, I think that's how the saying goes, something like that. Whatever you think, you know, you're right. You think you're going to be great, you're right, you are. You're not sure you're going to be great? No, you probably won't be. There's a belief system that goes along.
He had a belief system that surpassed yours and I. Because my guess is you practice your tail off too.
And always had doubts. Yeah, always had doubts, always had fears, always wasn't sure if I was good enough. You know, there's a belief system that develops along the way there somewhere. And once you develop the belief system, but you really believe it, and if you talk to the different athletes in different sports who succeed at different levels, I think maybe the word is confidence also that goes with the belief. You know, they develop a confidence and a belief in what they're doing that makes them certainly have a leg up, if that's the right phrase, on everybody else who's not sure, you know, how good they are. And I learned this. I started to learn this. I'll tell you when I started to see it. I went to Europe with a kid named Bruce Haddad years ago, who was an All-American at Florida, Arizona State. And I took him over there to play in, like, the summer of 91. And he was playing a match against a guy, and he was losing the match, and the guy wasn't that good. And I said to Bruce, he's down a set in 4-2. And I'm against the back fence, and we're in Europe, and we got no money. And I'm thinking, dude, we got to win matches because we lose our housing if we lose, and I already lost. And he looks through the fence. He says to me, just relax. This match hasn't even started yet. Until the guy gets a set, five games, and the ball in his hand to serve, this is all bullshit. And I thought, oh, my God, what's he talking about? And then I start to watch, you know. I start to watch him slowly start chipping away. He believed that he was going to find a way to be successful. He was sure. Now, it didn't mean he was going to be, because the other guy's got something to say about it. But in that same situation, down a set in 4-2 and not having a place to sleep that night, I think that might have started to enter into my mind. Never entered into his mind. Never even for a minute. And if it did, he didn't care. He just didn't care. He was just going to be in that moment.
If I was going to ask you what the most important trait a tennis player can possess that you would want, if you could teach anybody this one trait, it sounds like it might be belief. But I don't know how to teach that. Do you?
Yeah, you teach belief with visualization and relaxation training. And confidence, you teach confidence and belief. Confidence comes from, where does confidence come from? Success. Where does success come from? Setting a goal and achieving it. What I always do with my freshmen at Miami, the first week of school, we set a goal. What time are you setting your alarm? Okay, you set your alarm, it goes off, you get up, no snooze button, and you keep a log. So we start with a goal. They achieve, little thing, achieve the goal. Before I'm going to ask these guys to win matches under pressure, they've got to experience success and develop confidence. So it starts off with getting out of bed when you're supposed to in the morning. It starts with showing up what time you're supposed to be there. It starts with hitting those 100 serves. We write it down. Here's the goals for the day. Success, we achieve the goals. Ooh, I feel confident. you know, the belief system. We sit down, we do the visualization. We used to visualize when these guys were freshmen, we would visualize holding that MAC championship trophy in the air while we were in last place their freshman year. You know, do I think that had everything to do with them starting to believe what they could do? Yeah, I do. Absolutely, 100%. You visualize, I used to visualize, you know, it never really worked for me, but, you know, I used to visualize shaking hands with the tournament director and getting the check at the end of the week on Sunday afternoon and winning the tournament and, you know, all these sorts of things that you can visualize. You got to know that in your life there have been times when you have visualized something and it's come true at some point in time, almost like you're psychic. That's the power of visualization.
It's something I don't work on enough in practice, if at all. And I got to
admit that. I think you have to do it more with a certain level player than you have to with others. You know, but certainly if you're going to move from level to level to level, there are a couple of skill sets that are required in tennis. If you're going to move from one level to the next, you've got to play better on the run. You've got to be able to play the ball better on the rise or hit it earlier. And you've got to be able to take pace off a ball or use more of the court, angle, whatever, topspin lob, different things. Part of also you have to do is you've got to believe. You've got to believe, you know, think about tennis. What tennis used to be so nice before the international player in college because of the pecking order. It's all a big pecking order. I went at Miami, Ohio, recruited all the kids in the Midwest who didn't quite make it to Kalamazoo. And all the kids who are real good, you know, you got one kid one time I tried to recruit from Michigan. I don't remember his name, Upper, big kid from Michigan somewhere, went and played for you in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and a couple other kids played for you. And the good kids went to Wisconsin, and they went to Ohio State, and they went to Indiana. They didn't come to Miami. So I had to convince my kids that they could beat guys they've been losing to their whole life. See, that was the challenge. Then the foreign player comes, so I get a kid named, you know, Boris Cepeshi, who shows up at Miami as a freshman from Slovakia, and Boris don't give a crap that we're playing Illinois or Notre Dame or Wisconsin or Indiana. These are nothing to him. He's been playing, you know, wherever he's been playing, he doesn't know. So he has no preconceived belief about who these guys are and how he's supposed to do with them or against them. So he's just free and easy out there playing. To me, that's been the biggest thing about the international player, is they've taken away a lot of the pecking order of college tennis. Because those guys don't know from these other people, and they don't care.
All right, I want to get your thoughts on something else. I hope I can learn something here, too. You had Creasy on your show, who's a Hall of Fame coach and one of the all-time greats, and you had Dick Gould, who, if you're going to pick one guy in college tennis that may have been the greatest coach of our era, it might have been him with all the NCAA championships he won. Yet Gould says, we never practice Saturday or Sunday. We never practice more than 2 hours a time. And you've got Chuck, who is at the other end. And I got my own ideas, but I want to get your thoughts on that. There's obviously a lot of ways to get it done, but what are your thoughts on that? I mean, you got one guy unbelievably successful at one end of the spectrum and the other at the other. So
depends on the players. I would say that if I was a gambling man, I would say that, and I talked with Carter Morris, who played for Dick Gould, about this, and I asked him some questions, and Carter kind of went through it with me a little bit. These guys would still go out there on their own. You know, they wanted to do well. They had some other guys in town, some other coaches that some of them would go see who would work with them. They were putting it in, but it was in a little different format than Chuck was doing it. I don't know if anyone's ever been as good as Chuck was, as taking somebody from one level. Let's just say that an NCAA champion is two standard deviations to the right of the mean. You know, Chuck would take guys who were to the left of the mean, one or two standard deviations, and move them, you know, two standard deviations to the right. Richard Matuszewski and Craig Boynton and Jay Berger, who was good but got even better, and, you know, Jesus Rojas and, you know, what's his name from Florida who coached at Georgia Tech? John Desdunes. And he took a bunch of regular guys, you know, and I used to look at them. They were like me. We were the same in the juniors. And now these guys are professional tennis players ranked in the top 100, and I'm ranked 800. So, you know, for those guys, you know, that was the way to go. Who knows what would have happened had Chuck gotten guys like Paul Goldstein to come play for him. I don't know what would have happened. Sure might have been interesting, though.
Yeah. Hey, give me a favorite.
Hey, Getty, let's take a quick commercial real quick. Let's throw this Nike commercial in here real quick, and then we'll be right back in about 60 seconds. Folks, this is Bruce Lipka today with Coach Dave Getz. Our call-in number, 714-583-6853. Got plenty of time here to go today, so stay with us while we break for a commercial.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
All right, folks, back on the show. Coach Dave Getz here with us today. Getzy got me on the hot seat here and throwing the questions at me fast and furious. Getzy, you know, pick it up where we left off. We're talking a little about the coaches who do things differently. And, you know, I'll tell you, one of the guys who used to seem to have a magic formula was Bill Richards at Ball State. You know, Bill seemed to recruit a bunch of guys that I'd never really heard of, but all of a sudden guys start showing up there, and they're ranked in the top 20 in the country, and they're tremendous players, and they're good competitors. But then all of a sudden in his later years, you know, the program wasn't near as good. So I'm wondering, you know, what would – I think Coach Gould's program in the modern world right now would be just what it was. I don't think it would be any less. And just speaking with him, but yet Bill Richards, who just retired after 40 years or whatever, for many years in there – had a top 20 program, but it's been years since he was ranked anywhere near there, and I don't know why. You know, a guy doesn't forget his knowledge. A guy doesn't – I'm not sure why. So it would be interesting to try to examine some things like that at some point. Oops, sorry, Getzy. Had the – hang on a minute. I got the mute. There you are. You there now?
Yeah, my theory on that is I think that it just got way more competitive, that people weren't slipping through the cracks anymore, that coaches were hustling a lot more, they're going to a lot more tournaments, they're getting the guys that Bill Richards used to get, you know, just good athletes, and they were recruiting on potential. I think that happened a little bit, but, you know, that brings me up to another question. I want to know, give me your top five coaches that you run into, guys you think, some people that really impress you in the tennis field. This will put you on the hot seat. You'll leave somebody out, and they'll get pissed at you if they're listening.
Yeah, well, you know. Well, I think the best coach I've ever seen, and it's not even close, was Bill Timm, who I've spent a lot of time with. I spent a fair bit of time with Bill over the years, and he has had a player who he has started from nothing. In every place he's ever been, has made it to the Grand Slam tournaments. And I don't know anyone else who can say that. I'm not talking about someone shows up with Maria Sharapova, who's so good they move from Russia here when she's 9. I'm talking about Bill gets them started in the beginning, and they end up playing in the Grand Slam tournaments. And I don't know anybody else who's...
Can't you pick up on what Bill did and replicate it? Was it a special personality? What was it? Tell me his formula.
Bill has a methodology. He's got a methodology, and it is repeatable. It's valid, and it's repeatable, which is why it's worked every stop he's ever been at, and which is why, you know, it's what I've copied and it's what works for me. You know, Bill's basic theory is he's going to teach you to know the game so that you can coach yourself in a nutshell. You're going to know everything about the game you need to know. And that's what he's teaching you. You know, and I've watched some guys over the years, you know, Peter Smith was fairly impressive. You know, when I watched him a couple years ago in terms of work ethic and putting the guys, you know, through their paces at practice. You know, when I was younger, Mr. Hopman was an incredibly impressive guy to be on the tennis court with. You know, you talk about a guy who understood the value of hard work. I mean, you know, these are the commonalities, you know, that I see. I mean, but I spent time with Nick Bollettieri, and, you know, I'm going to leave him out of my top five list. I'll say he's one of the greatest tennis minds and promoters of all time, but I'm not sure where he comes out as far as coaches or developers of players. Obviously, someone goes to Jimmy Arias, showed up at his academy and as a phenom already, and, you know, some of the other guys. You know, there was, you know, somehow you know, over the years, you know, I've run across, there's a fella in Miami, you know, who's at a little park for years, Bobby Curtis, where Des Dunes used to play. And, you know, Bobby, you know, used to have a bunch of kids down there years and years ago, and they didn't do anything fancy, and a lot of the kids came out and were pretty good players. You know, and he'd have them working hard. He'd have them out there all day long at the park, you know, nothing else to do. You know, as far as the college guys, it's so tough to say, where do you draw the line between a guy who's a good recruiter, a guy who's a good developer of players? You know, that's a very tough thing to say. You know,
yeah.
Craig Tiley had some great programs, but, you know, with the recruiting classes that Craig had, you know, when he was winning with the Matt Snyders of the world, and what was the fellow from Lyle, Illinois? Jeff?
God, I remember. Lasky.
Yeah.
Jeff Lasky.
I mean, when he was winning the national indoors with teams made up of Gavin Sontag and those guys, that was something. Because those guys were solid coming out of the juniors, but those guys were not national, you know, champion caliber players. So there must have been something going on there, you know. And then when he got in the real good players, the class of Stolt, Wilson, Calkins, Delek, Ram, Martin, I mean, whatever he was doing to get those regular guys to national championship top five caliber, of course he was able to take that next group over the top. But you know, that's in the college setting. I'm not sure, you know, when it comes to outside of college, you know, other coaches – you know, I don't run into a lot of guys that are really impressive. You know, I was over in Europe, and I run into a few guys over there who, you know, what's most impressive about them is they're not impressive. They're not flashy. They're not the, you know, USOC Coach of the Year. They're not the USPTA Pro of the Decade. They're not a master professional. You know, these guys who fall outside the lines of what we suffer from in this society, our high arrogance, low self-esteem. These are guys of very low arrogance but very high self-esteem who believe in what they're doing and know what they're doing, and they don't have to tell anybody else. And we don't hear a lot from those guys or about those guys because they're not trying to convince anyone else that they're good at what they do.
What do you think they're doing differently in Spain that we're not doing in the U.S. to produce great players?
They're having a bad economy. They're having less education. And they're having less ways out other than sport. So you want to play soccer, you want to play tennis, you want to ride bikes, you want out, that's kind of the way to go. And they're hungrier, they're less spoiled, they're less entitled. There's, you know, I mean, I was over there, no cars, you know, not every family has two cars and a garage and a this and a that. You got an apartment and one car and you got a bike. We saw a couple of moms riding a bicycle with a kid like on the handlebars or on the back, like we used to do when we were kids, before we were spoiled and our moms drove us everywhere. And this is like moms and kids doing this over there. It's a completely different philosophical way that they approach life. And there's minuses in it also, because there's a little bit of a what I call a head-down mentality where they, you know, some people think they're stuck where they are. But, you know, that's why I think over here we have tons of opportunity, but it seems like our immigrant kids are ones who are doing so much, particularly in our sport. You know, they still have a work ethic. They're not as entitled.
Yeah.
They're not as spoiled. Very difficult, you know, with the level of entitlement in some places to succeed athletically.
I see you on Facebook sometimes, and with like little quotes from Confucius or people like Eastern religions. Like, give me your favorite quote or something that you figure out. This is something I live my life by.
Well. You know, one of the things that I've really come to think that is a pretty good one is this one. The universe doesn't make mistakes. Everything is happening just as it should. It's only our perception of difficulties that causes us the distress and the difficulty we experience. Not only that, but when we label events as bad, we fail to perceive the benefit that is waiting for us. You know, I've come to really believe that that's pretty accurate for life. If you walk through life with a victimology and you walk through life and thinking that this isn't supposed to happen to me and this wasn't how it's supposed to be, you know, I think you're missing the benefit that you can get from all things that are going on around you. You know, and that's a big one for me, one of my favorites.
You know, if you could give out, you got a player, he's good. If you could, if it's just a generic thing, if you could give out one piece of advice that you could give anybody that you think is something that, that's a fundamental to being successful on the tennis court or wherever, give me that. Give me the Lipkin number one piece of advice.
Coaches don't make players. Players make players. You want to be a player? We've outlined it for you. Now you got to go do it. Can't stand around waiting for the coach to make you a player. You want to be a player? Here's
that.
The courts. Did you run to the courts today? Did you run? Why don't you go run the 2 miles to the wall, hit on the wall for an hour, then run the back to 2 miles? I mean, whatever it might be. You want to be a player? Then become a player. Mom doesn't need to drive you anywhere. The coach doesn't need to meet you at the courts. You got a teammate. You got a hopper balls. You got a ball machine. I mean, coaches don't make players. Players make players. You want to be a player? Fine. Become a player.
You know, as a tennis coach, I'm not sure people outworked you. I don't think that was possible. I remember some of the crazy stuff you used to do recruiting, sleeping in the back of your car, driving 12 hours one way, then driving back with a peanut butter sandwich in the front seat. I mean, but as a player, so my guess, if you were a coach like that, as a player, you must have been like that. How come you didn't make top 100? I know why I didn't make it.
No belief.
Crappy backhand, couldn't return serve. Well, how about you?
Couldn't get out of my own way. Couldn't get out of my own way. I just, the belief system, for some reason, you know, my dad was a coach, my uncle was a coach. You know, for some reason I had an innate belief. You know, I got started coaching accidentally. I was playing, and I wasn't doing that well. So I'd lose in the qualies every week and play some doubles. I'd be main draw, but singles I wasn't qualifying. And, you know, a couple friends of mine who were qualifying every week said, hey, you know, can you help me? If you help me, I'll pay for the hotel room. If you help me, I'll buy dinner tonight. Hey, can you work with me today a little bit? So I started to help a couple of guys I was traveling with, and I started to really enjoy it, and they started to do really well. And I really believed in myself. I don't know that I ever believed in myself as a tennis player. In fact, I'm positive. I never believed in myself as a player and in my abilities as well as I believed in myself as a coach or my ability to develop a player. And I don't know why that is. I don't know how that came about, but it all goes back to that belief system. I mean, I look at these players on TV and, you know, I watch some of them play and I think, you know, I remember watching Tsonga last year at Wimbledon and how Tsonga kept approaching from so deep in the court, only down the line and hitting it so hard that he could pass cross court every time and he looked like a buffoon out there. And I remember thinking to myself, does he not have a coach who's watching this who can, you know, somehow communicate to him, hey, before the next match, how about we do this? And I just, there's something about it that I believe in it. I believe in myself when I do it. And I don't know that I believe in myself in any other place on this planet, in any other activity I could be doing, whether it's anything from cooking to parenting to being the director of my club, like I believe in my skill set to help somebody reach their potential as a player.
Yeah. No, I think that's, I don't know, that's why I was curious to pick your brain. That's why I asked to come on and get to ask the questions instead. You done anything lately worth remembering?
No, you know, like I say, I went to Spain last week and played a little on the red clay and played a little event called Potter Cup. And, you know, I wish I knew a little bit about yoga a little more when I was coaching. I would have liked to a couple days a week had my athletes do a little one-hour yoga class. It seems to be very restorative and real good for the flexibility. You know, I enjoy some of the cross-training now that I try to get the kids doing, you know, in the exercise classes, as I guess you'd call them. You know, I try to get the variety in some of it. But, you know, it still comes down to there's only so many hours in the day. And, you know, if I've got some kid who wants to be a good player and I say, hey, what time do you get up for school? And he says 7 o'clock. We got to leave the house at 7:30. And I say, well, why don't you get up at 6:40? Why don't you put 20 minutes in of jump rope push-ups and sit-ups for 15 minutes, then take a shower? You know, 15 minutes, 5 days a week, you know, that'll add up for you to an hour and 15 minutes more work you're putting in. That's going to add up to a lot of hours per week, per month, per year. And, you know, still I've yet to see a guy who says, boy, I'm going to do that. So, you know, some things don't change, and I still think those players are unique. You know, you've had them over the years, a guy who comes by and he's not necessarily big or he's not necessarily fast. He's not necessarily pretty looking. There was a boy here playing the other day, a friend of mine, Damon Gooch, who teaches locally. He came over with some guys he's working with. We played some doubles. And the boy's name was Cameron, and he plays at Elon in North Carolina. And the boy had a pretty awkward game, but it didn't matter. The boy knows how to play. You know, he kind of rolls the ball, slices the ball. It's like a poor man's Santoro. You know, and these guys, these unique guys, I love when I come across these unique guys who aren't just cookie cutter like everybody else. You know, and I think that's one of the things lately is I've been trying to encourage my players to, you know, find a guy who we want to be like, but we don't all have to be Nadal or Federer. You know, we could find another guy out there we can emulate that might suit what we want to be and what we want to do. You know, and
yeah.
I try to encourage them in that direction. Because it's good if we have a picture and we try to emulate the picture. That's always a good thing. However, the picture doesn't only have to be that one or two guys. Hell, it could be some local guy, you know, who played in college who you actually get to go on the court with because he lives near you and he hits with you. Great. Emulate him. You know, physically, stroke-wise. You know, mentally, of course, I don't think you do much better than emulate these, you know, the Federers and the Nadals of the world because mentally they're so tough. But it's, you know, the tennis in this country, we've got our work cut out for us, but I do think that we suffer from limiting beliefs. And if we can eliminate the limiting beliefs, then I think there becomes, you know, I look at that Virginia match this year in the finals of the NCAAs against UCLA. I mean, how does that happen? How does that happen that this guy from UCLA has got this easy ball on top of the net, close it, win the match, done, national champion, and Virginia, who's had all these opportunities to win, can never pull it off, but then all of a sudden this crazy turn of events happens and Virginia wins? Because I think they really believed that. They believed. UCLA didn't. When you believe, crazy stuff happens.
Yeah, that's right. So you instill the belief. You instill the belief with visualization on a daily basis. Maybe you take 5 minutes of your practice of all, and you do it on a daily basis.
I think you
basis.
Take about a half an hour, 20 minutes to 30 minutes. You know, I used to have the guys we used to meet in the locker room. We'd all lay down on the floor. I would talk them through the visualization. We'd get into the relaxation. We'd get into the elevator. As the floors would go deeper, we'd go deeper into relaxation. And I taught them how to do it. We did it ourselves every day for a week, and then I asked them to do it themselves each day. So you'd walk into our locker room, and there could be any number of guys laying on the floor with a towel over their head, doing their visualization.
See, I got away from that. When I was a coach at Minnesota, we practiced at private clubs. They'd only give us the club for 2 hours, from 2 to 4. At 4 o'clock, the junior program would come on and they'd kick us off. We better have every last ball picked up and be out of there at 4 because they weren't our courts and the kids were paying money. So I had 2 hours. And that's why I never did that. For 18 years, I couldn't get there earlier. We had to take a van 30 minutes to practice. And so my thing was I got to get the most out of this 2 hours I possibly can. We're going to hit balls. We're just going to hit more balls than anybody could possibly hit in 2 hours. And if I look back and I had to do it all over again, I would have used that van ride for visualization. I would have done some more of the stuff that you suggested that I didn't do. And now I'm in the same quandary at Penn and Ivy League school because kids are pressed for time. So I got 2 hours, 2.5 hours max I can probably do a day. What do you do? You got two and a half hours.
A lot of time. You know what I think is beneficial, I can only speak from the outside. I'm not there. I've been to your campus, and I'm hoping that the lacrosse coach recruits my son. And, you know, and I'd like to spend more time with you. But not being there, I know what – I think what's changed in the world is maybe there's team practice and there's more one-on-one stuff, and the one-on-one stuff is not just on the court. You know, maybe, you know, what I'd like to do at practice each day is I like to do a series of drills that both build athleticism, conditioning, and the habits that I want on the court. I like to have constructed point play game plan work each day where particularly we'll be working on, you know, the parts of kids' games that they didn't use as much of, the serve and volley or the chip and charge. You know, I would also like to make sure we did serve and return every day. Because nothing's more important than serve and return.
How long do you hit serves for?
I want every kid to hit 100 serves every day if we could. If I was limited in court time or the weather was bad, we might limit it to two balls, two serve sequences, first and second serve, one guy serving, one guy's returning. You know, I was big on cooperative practice. So we're going to hit serves and returns, and you got to hit every serve in the target so this guy can hit a return every time. Because if you're going to hit 40 serves and you miss 10, he only got to hit 30 returns. So the guys really became cooperative with each other to realize the benefit of how much time we had to work with. But, you know, and then there's always a little bit of conditioning maybe that you can do. You know, but then there's, you know, maybe you're only doing team practice in that context X days a week, and maybe a couple of days a week it's, you know, it's one-on-one stuff or it's two-on-one or it's three guys. And, you know, I'm thinking that maybe I would reinvent the way I did practice in today's world, particularly at an Ivy League school where kids have certain academic demands and kids are busier than they used to be.
Give me, what do you think the correct ratio is of drilling to point play? And I listened to a seminar once where Saviano talked about dead ball drills, and dead ball drills are done, a thing of the past. But, you know, I do a lot of dead ball drills. I still think there's a place for them.
No, I like the dead ball drills.
What do you think the correct ratio is?
I don't think there's a correct ratio. I think there's the amount of work it's going to take to form some habits. We're trying to form some habits. What are we trying to do here? And once you know what you're trying to do, then try to do it. You know, we used to go through every day. I mean, my players weren't good. They just weren't in the beginning. We ended up getting a couple international guys who weren't bad, but they just weren't good. They are guys ranked, you know, 25, 30 in the Western section. They never seen Kalamazoo. So, you know, we'd start off with our dead ball drills, and the guys, I'd make them feed each other. You know, every other court was a hopper on a different end of the court, and we had our eight guys out there. You know, four guys are feed, four guys hit, and go. First round, here we go. We did a four-ball drill, a three-ball drill, a two-ball drill. You know, we put sequence of shots together, and then we went to our live ball drills from there. And then from our live ball drills, we went into our game plans. And then from our game plans, we went into our point play. And then from our point play, you know, we'd say, okay, I'd say, okay, it's 4-3, you're serving down, finish the set. Because maybe we only had 30 minutes to work with left. And, you know, then we'd do our conditioning and then, you know, call it a day. And each guy was supposed to have done, you know, his visualization work before practice and come out and do his serves and his returns before or after if possible. If not, you know, we'd do it during practice. But, you know, it's a constant moving target that would depend and require adjustment based on your kids' schedules, how much time you have, where are you in the season. But I just think there are certain things that you've got to cover regularly with the kids, and serve and return are two of those things. Every point starts with it. How can you not cover it every day?
Yeah. You got any drills you think are just mainstays that should be done, if not on a daily basis? But you just talked about serve and return. But you got any specific stuff that you really like? I want to steal a couple, and because sometimes in practice you get stale, so you always need to introduce kind of a new concept here or there.
I have a couple of drills that combine. You know, I think every drill I've come to find over the years has a negative. There's no such drill as the perfect drill. You can always accomplish some positives with a drill, but then there's always some negatives. So, you know, I try to separate, and we do a drill called hit, roll, puke, which I like a lot. You know, it kind of combines conditioning a little bit with hitting and moving. You know, we combine a drill. You know, I like to do – we never just hit. I never just hit. We're going to go out. We put our targets down, even if we're warming up. I don't like that nonsense where you stand on the service line and you play short court. I see no purpose with this, and it's a waste of 5 minutes. The last thing in the world I want is my players getting in the habit of hitting the ball on the bounce inside the service line. So, you know, we start off with the volley. We always volley first. We volley straight ahead, you know, press down with the lower body. Then we go side to side with the grip change and the angles and the drops. And then we go into a transition volley. It's the same series of drills. Grab a couple of your guys, come on down, and we'll go through it.
I want you to, if you can, over the phone, maybe it makes for bad radio, but I got some guys coming out for an afternoon workout. I want you to tell me how to do hit, roll, puke.
Hit, roll, puke. FaceTime. You got the Apple phone. Well, FaceTime. You can watch me and Hakone do it, one of the guys who works with me. Hit, roll, puke, straight.
Right.
You hit, you roll the ball, and then everyone pukes.
You know, before I got to put you on the hot seat, I want you to tell me something about yourself that nobody knows. I have a guess that, you know, the guy who straps the ball machine and fires balls at him and makes the guys practice like maniacs and is 100% committed, will drive 12 hours for a recruiting visit and drive back or put thumbtacks in the back of their shoes. The thing I think I know about you that most people don't is I think deep down inside you're really kind of a big saucy. You got a good growl, but
a gooey
you're not
center.
Fight that hard. What's that?
Yeah,
a
gooey center could
center.
Be. I think everything that motivates me has always motivated me from a point of fear, you know, fear of failure. You know, you've always got to do a little bit more. You always got to try a little harder. You know, you can always do a little bit more. And that's, you know, where does that come from, you know? That probably comes from a couple of deep, dark places, you know, of things that happened to you when you were a kid and kind of emblazon upon you a belief system that, you know, makes you think that whatever you're doing, you're not good enough, so you just got to work harder and harder and harder. And then, you know, one day as one of my friends, James Shore, always tells me, I'm perfect just the way I am. And, you know, when you come to believe that you're perfect just the way you are and everybody else shows up perfect just the way they are, you know, I think that's my soft, gooey center coming out, maybe.
how do you get guys to buy into what you want to do and to buy into the work ethic it takes to be great? What's the biggest thing you do to sell that buy-in?
You know, they have to decide. You know, it's funny because you know, these examples are always all around us. You know, my friend Joe Mesmer, who you know is a director down here, his son Freddie's a nice little player. And Freddie came out the other day when I was, you know, we're doing some stuff with these guys who, you know, we play a little doubles. Then I say, hey, let's run some sprints. So, you know, we line up. You know, they're college kids. So when you say, hey, line up on the line and get ready to run, they run. They don't say, oh, I don't want to. Oh, I'm tired. You know, the juniors I got to say, okay, let's run a little now. Oh, do we got to run? I'm tired. I got to go home and do homework. You know, but these guys who you never met before who are, you know, visiting you at your club and playing tennis with you, you know, you say, get on the line, put four balls down, boom, there they go. And they worked hard, and I guess my friend Joe called me up tonight. He says, Freddie came home tonight all fired up. He says he's ready. He says he needs it. He wants to work with you now. And Joe says, I've been asking Freddie for years. Hey, he says, Freddie walked in and said, Dad, can you call Mr. Lipka and see if he can help me? And I've been trying to help Freddie for years, but Freddie wasn't ready for help. Now, Freddie wants help. So anything I can do to help him, he's ready. I'll help him, and he'll get more out of it than he ever would have. So with your guys, you can't sell anybody on anything. You know, what's that old saying? When the student's ready, the teacher appears?
Yeah.
Guys got to wake up inside, you know.
You don't have any tricks of the trade for me to inspire guys to get fire in their apps.
I don't think they're, you know, with the international player, Boris Cipesci showed up, I had some leverage because I had to write a letter to the Army that said he was in school. So I'd say, Boris, if you don't work your ass off every day for me, then I'm revoking this letter and you can go home and fight in Bosnia or wherever they're fighting these days. He's like, oh, no, Coach Lipka, I work very hard. And so I had leverage. But, you know, what leverage do you have? A kid's got to either value the education if he's a scholarship or, you know, I hear the Ivy kids, a lot of kids sometimes, you know, they value it. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they could give or take the tennis. Sometimes they want to be. They don't want to be. It's tough to say what makes a kid work, how he's wired. But I don't know that there's a trick other than, you know, good old-fashioned, genuine interest in a person's life. If someone really believes you're interested in them and their well-being and want to see them reach their potential as a person, maybe they're a little bit more likely to respond. But, you know, there's so much crap nowadays about winning and Sears Cup standings, whatever it's called these days, and how you in your conference and what are you ranked. And, you know, as opposed to just, hey, we're going to help you develop into the best person you can be. And why are we going to do that the way we're going to do it? Because under duress, you're going to find out who you really are. And that's going to be why we play tennis, and that's going to be why we train. And, you know, everything about this is to prepare you for the rest of your life, how to handle duress, how to handle success, time management, you know your personality in good times and bad. What do you like when you're hungry? What do you like when you're tired? You're going to know everything about yourself you need to know as you leave school and venture into the world. You know, and that's really what the laboratory of college tennis can be, as opposed to, did we win? Yeah, I think that's a little bit of a, that's a little bit of a problem, did we win? Now, that doesn't mean it's a cop-out that you're not trying to do everything you can. You know, if you've given a guy a game plan and he didn't execute it because he's scared, well, we're not getting where we need to be. We need a guy who, you know, I like to tell the players, fearless but not foolish, you know, when they go out to play. Play fearlessly, but don't play foolishly. No whimsy, no nonsensical shots at the wrong times. But fearless that you go for your shots, you do your thing the way you've been trained, and let the chips fall where they may.
Hey, you want to bounce some ideas off somebody, you want to try and continually improve your knowledge base in tennis, and you want to continually try and get better, who's the guy, who's your go-to guy? Who do you talk to for advice? When you need some advice on something,
Bill Timm. Talk to him all the time, and it's great for two reasons. One, he doesn't take any crap. You know, he'll say, you know, if you've called someone to blow sunshine up your ass, you got the wrong guy, and he'll say it how it is. But number two, he's the brightest man I've ever known. He sees things, you know, he's Columbus. When Columbus said the world was round and everyone said it's flat, Bill's Columbus. He knows the world's round and everyone else still thinks it's flat. And any tennis coach worth his salt who really wants to be the best he can be should pilgrimage to Nashville. You know, Bill takes on all callers. He'll talk to anybody. He'll be happy to have people observe what he does when he's working with his good players, when he's working with his bad players. I've never, ever met anybody in any field of life who's as intelligent as Bill, as an insightful at everything regarding the human condition, the tennis player, the human personality. He's unrivaled.
You know, I kind of knew the answer to that question, and I talked to you about 10 years ago. I don't know if you remember this, but you kind of told me the same thing.
I told you the same thing.
I had a couple questions. I had a couple questions.
You still aren't listening.
And I called Bill Timm, just, and I don't really know Bill Timm all that well. We never played Vanderbilt. I mean, I run into him once in a while. But Bill Timm took a lot of time and put a lot of effort in and to explain a few things to me, his thoughts. And I thought the same thing as you did. I thought the guy was great. Well, number one, great he'd take the time to talk to me for as long as he did. And I thought his ideas and thoughts were great, too. So, yeah, I concur about that.
I think
that.
So. I would, you know, and I tell folks on the show all the time, you know, Bill's written a bunch of things. Bill sends out a bunch of emails now. Now that he's technologically savvy, when he sends an email out to one of his players, he copies about 50 people on it, everyone from Brian Shelton and Kenny Thorne to, you know, Scott Davidoff, who's a tour coach, and even our man J.P. Weber's gotten in on it. You know, and Bill copy every one of his students, and, you know, you give Bill a call and give him your email and tell him to add you to the list. And it's, I told him to start a Facebook page, Bill Timm Tennis, and he said, what's that? And I said, well, we'll go through that next. But he's certainly he's my go-to guy. I always love, you know, some folks call every now and again or send an email to hear the show, and you know, I like to talk to people about it, but I don't pretend to think that I'm as knowledgeable as Bill is.
All right, I got one last question for you then. Tell me what I forgot to ask that you think would be valuable information. I want to know, you know what, as a learning perspective, maybe a few things you picked up that you think everybody should be doing, or, you know, whether it's a drill you like, whether it's how to run a practice, whether it's what you look for in a kid, or how to help develop kids, or how to structure your practice, anything.
The one thing that I've picked up is there are no tricks. There's no magic bullet. There's no one thing. There's no one-liners. There's no guy who seems to know. I think most people know too much for their own good. They're just full of crap, and they really don't know anything. It's simple. It's a very simple thing. You want your guys to play better? Great. What's the object of the game? The object of the game is to keep getting one more ball back more than the other guy can. Well, you need to be supremely physically fit and mentally fit to do that. Because going out there all alone, playing the matches by yourself, you have no help. This is not a complicated game. It's complicated by the time we get a hold of people and the habits they have are what they are in order to try to change some of them. That's challenging. But the game in and of itself and the training for the game, I don't know, I think a lot of guys might be a little short-sighted. You know, I think they may not. You know, it's interesting because we talk in this country about, you know, we picture the clay quarters as just kind of retrievers. And, you know, I just came back from this event, and these guys were over there, and they play. They serve and volley on the red clay. They come in. They stay back. They drop. They loop. Their grips aren't so extreme. They do all kinds of stuff.
The Spaniards,
Italians, the French, these guys all play beautiful all-court tennis. You know, and I don't know if we're playing all-court tennis in this country or not, but I think for the most part, my job and any of our jobs as a coach is probably to create the most well-rounded player we can because they're only as good as the options that we teach them. You know, and it's like Bill used to do this demonstration real quick. I got about a minute here before they cut us off. He used to put a piece of wood out there with a screw, a nail, a hammer, and a screwdriver. And he basically would ask a guy to come up and hammer the nail in with the screwdriver, and you can't do that, or screw the nail in with the hammer, and you can't do that. So if we don't give the guys the right tools to use, then we make it very difficult for them to do their job. And that's our job as a coach, give them the right tools.
All right, Bruce. You know what? I had my pencil, and I took a few notes, and I knew I'd get something out of it. It was like an hour talk with you, and I got a few good things out of it, and it didn't take me a week and a half to read a book to get it. So thanks for having me on.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you. It's just, you know, it's like what I love about this show. It's just me and my buddy talking about tennis and everyone else gets to listen.
Yeah.
Getsy, it was a pleasure. I look forward to seeing you soon. Hopefully we'll be up in Philly again to visit the school a little bit with my kids. And sorry that we missed you on the last trip, but I look forward to us chatting some more at some point in time.
All right. See you, Bruce.
Take care, my friend.
Folks,
that's today's show. Fantastic show. For me anyway, because I got to talk about tennis, and that's what I love to do. Hope you guys picked something up out there today and enjoyed yourselves. Hopefully you'll join us next week. Stay with us for our disclaimer and get out there and hit some balls.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.